Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello and welcome to Project Zion, the Restoration Caffeinated. Grounds for Peace is a new international podcast that comes from the work of peaceprojects.eu. In this series, we are asking, what are the grounds, you might say the foundations, for a new peaceful humanity? I am your host, Joey Williams, member of the Community of Christ European Peace and Justice Team and Mission Center President for the Western Europe Mission Center. According to Steve Veazey, President of Community of Christ, no matter where we start from as individuals, our calling, our purpose as a human species is to be a peaceful humanity. The phrase peaceful humanity is another way of saying Zion, God's vision or dream for the world. Today, our guests are Ryan and Georgia Commons, who have just done a webinar for us on nonviolence and what we eat. In their webinar session, they helped answer the question, can peace begin on our plates? And I have to say, they did a great job. Georgia has a love for literature and has recently finished a 4-year degree in English literature. She is now pursuing her master's. Ryan graduated with a degree in theology and religious studies and soon will be starting a new job teaching philosophy and religion. Both Georgia and Ryan have been living a plant-based lifestyle for 4 years. So Georgia and Ryan, welcome. It is so good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having us, Jerry.
Yeah.
So I want you to walk me through a slaughterhouse experience. So you guys have actually gone to the slaughterhouse. Mm-hmm. Walk me through that experience. Where did you go? What were the smells? You know, you mentioned with the vigil, mm-hmm. chickens, the smell, the sights, the connection.
Yeah.
What mm-hmm. was happening in that place, in that space, and what impact did it have on you?
So we had to get up very early to go there, really early, because we live in cities and generally speaking, slaughterhouses don't like kind of just live around the corner in a city. So we had to get like several buses and yeah, bumpy country roads and stuff to kind of get there. So that was, you know, an experience in and of itself trying to get there. In all honesty, it's a lot of sort of ups and downs throughout the whole thing, because it can be, maybe it sounds like a psychopathic thing to say, but there are elements of it that can be nice, because, you know, there's a lot of other fellow vegans there and you normally bring like snacks. Like I remember the people that we were at them with always brought like really nice dark chocolate digestive biscuits and strawberries and crisps and stuff. And and the trucks come pretty often, but there's still like, you know, significant period of time where you're waiting for the next one to arrive, where you're just kind of hanging out and talking with the people sort of there with you. Yeah. So then, you know, but then when a truck does arrive, you know, it kind of gets pulled over and stopped, and you sort of then go up to it and you know, you're looking at the animals. You might, lots of people do different things. I've heard some people say a prayer for the animal there, you know. Sometimes people, you know, live stream it to their social media so that people can see what's happening and things. Take pictures of the animals. And sometimes something that I did a few times was just to kind of try and be present with the animal. So maybe like film and take some pictures of some of them, but also then just spend time with like just sort of one individual chicken, like, you know, looking it in the eye and focusing on seeing it as an individual. Sometimes you can, if they're a bit, you know, uneasy and really sort of nervous and anxious, sometimes you can like stroke them through the cage, and they get, after a while, they sort of chill and they relax into it. And, you know, so many moving times I would be doing that, and the chicken would start to go to sleep and would, you know, lean into my hand. And I almost found that more upsetting in a way, because it was just like, you know, they were just so desperate for some affection. And that's when it really drives home to you how young these chickens are as well. They're babies. They might have the bodies of adults, but they're babies in terms of their, you know, their lifespan. So yeah, and then you have about 2 minutes of that. And sometimes, you know, the drivers can be aggressive and stuff, but, you know, there are instances where activists, you know, might be aggressive as well. You know, we never had that happen at the ones we were at, but, you know, it does happen. It's a very emotionally charged situation. And then the truck goes in and it kind of disappears from view. And for legal reasons, they don't let the vegans on site in the actual, what is it called? The bit where they actually slaughter the animals.
The slaughter? No,
I can't remember. I mean, it's not that important anyway, but you're not allowed into that actual bit is what I'm trying to say. And then sort of on average, I say it's maybe about 10, 15 minutes max. And then the truck comes out again. And like I shared in the webinar, that's the most haunting part for me, is because it's just completely empty and silent. And, you know, it's dripping wet because it's been hastily hosed down. And it has to be hosed down for health and safety, because I'm not kidding you, the smell that comes from them trucks, it's foul. They defecate on top of each other. There's all kinds of horrible stench that comes from it. And on hot days as well during the summer, it's horrible. The ones that we went to were all chicken slaughters. We haven't been to any ones for pigs or cows. They just weren't, they weren't where the slaughterhouses around us were sort of dealing with. It was mainly chickens. But in my experience anyway, and from what I've heard other people say, the chickens tend to sadly get abused even more if possible, because they're just easier to manhandle. You know, like you can just pick up five or six of them in one go and kind of just throw them where you want them to go. Whereas, you know, you could not do that with a cow or a fully grown adult pig.
Are slaughterhouses the same thing as factories? Is it the same space?
No, not usually.
So generally, and that's quite an important question, because not all of the animals that end up in the slaughterhouse come from factory farms. Mm-hmm. You have factory farms where the animals will be born and they will be kept there until they're of a slaughtering age. And then they'll be driven. So for chickens, for instance, they'll be driven in these trucks, which are generally very large, usually thousands of chickens on a single truck, will then be driven to the slaughterhouse, where they'll be killed. And, you know, they spend no more than 15 minutes actually in the slaughterhouse. But it's an important distinction, because sometimes people have the idea that organic or free range animals have better lives, which may well be true, but they end up in the same slaughterhouses. And the experience there is not nice.
No. I think because one that we were at, one particular vigil, a couple of the activists did choose to, you know, risk their, like, you know, a legal battle, if you like. And they actually ran in alongside the truck and went in and were live stream filming during the kind of process of the chickens being unloaded. They were escorted out by police after about 10 minutes because obviously legally they're not allowed to be there. On a almost unrelated point, so I'm sorry if this makes it difficult for people to follow. One thing I would like to draw attention to that we noticed in particular, I noticed a big link between misogyny and slaughterhouses. In one company I'm thinking of in particular, their sort of slogan was like a sort of play on words to do with them having the best chicks and the best breasts in town. I remember I was there and I was just thinking how surreal it was to be at this slaughterhouse where the sort of owners of it, who do speak English, were telling us, you know, you need to respect our place, you need to respect our work, whilst they were not even showing respect towards human females. I don't know, that still makes me really angry when I think about that moment today. I think that was one of the few times when I did experience genuine kind of anger towards the people that owned the slaughterhouse, because I just thought, I don't know, do you even care about humans as well? And obviously that's not all of them. I know that's maybe just, you know, a particularly bad one. But I just remember that really annoyed me as a woman being there and being surrounded by that and then seeing chickens going in to be slaughtered as well.
And it wasn't just one play on words. They all around the slaughterhouses, they had all of these puns around kind of chicks, breasts, legs, things like that were just very objectifying.
And yeah.
One thing that we haven't quite mentioned about the experience of a slaughterhouse is what it sounds like. And that was very powerful to me, is that it's very silent most of the time. They're deathly quiet. And even when the trucks pull in, the chickens are so subdued. Not every time, actually. I one of the ones we went to, they were more agitated, and so they were moving around a lot, and there was kind of the scrabbling. But I remember the first one that we went to, I was just shocked by how they were just sitting there. Some of them had passed out, some of them were already dead by the time they'd arrived, and there was just no silence, except very occasionally you would hear them cheeping, because something that a lot of people don't realize is that typically, especially factory farmed chickens, which are the majority of chicken meat comes from, they're slaughtered about 5 weeks old. So they've been bred to grow the bodies of adult chickens very, very quickly, to the point where they can't support their own weight, and yet they're still just chicks. And so you just hear them cheeping very softly, and it's a very haunting experience, just the sound of it.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine that having a horrible sound, but also the silence has to be very creepy as well, mm-hmm. as you're experiencing just kind of this moment of, this is where we are and this is what we're doing here.
Yeah.
So let's go back then to where many of these animals would come from, would be in these factories. And you talked a lot in the webinar about these being unhealthy environments. And I'll mention a few things. You talked about them being bad for workers in these factories, that there's lots of accidents that happen that are reported and probably many that are unreported. And then as well as some of the mental health aspects for the workers. You talked about the communities that surround these factories suffering pollution of their water, their dumping sites, and probably a lot of horrible smells as well that go along with that, and other health problems and issues, and especially the structural racism that's built into these systems. You talked about the zoonotic diseases and coronavirus. You know, the jury's still out of whether that was actually something from one of these factories, but certainly bird flu and swine flu have all been attributed to these factory working conditions. Then you talked about climate change as well and the different effects of the different gas emissions on our global environment. And we could spend an entire podcast on each one of these items, but I'd really like to just give you a little more time for people who have seen the webinar or not seen the webinar, just spend a little more time on this idea of how what is on our plates might be contributing to racial exploitation and the heavy health consequences on low-income families and poorer neighborhoods.
So there's definitely structural racism inbuilt into our food system, as there is inbuilt into virtually all of our systems. So Wilfred Emmanuel Jones, who's the first black farmer in Britain, said, when I go to some of these big food companies, it's like going into a white enclave. How can you be in a city that's so diverse, and then you go into the nearest rural area where you don't spot a black person? And if there is a black person, that'll be the cleaner or the security guard. So part of the reason why this structural racism exists is that, on the one hand, the land, the agricultural land, is generally owned by white farmers, or it's owned by corporations that have white owners and white CEOs. However, much of the manual labor and much of the most difficult jobs is performed by low-paid black people or indigenous people or people of color. So this is certainly the case in the US. It's also the case in Europe. So, for example, in Spain, migrant workers from Africa, Asia, Latin America work under exploitative housing and labor conditions to produce food for predominantly white consumers. So there's that aspect of structural racism inbuilt there. Now, racial injustices in the food system are not limited to the animal agriculture industry. It takes place across the production of all food, and indeed throughout our entire economy. But in intensive animal farming, there's this extra layer that comes in, which is to do with the way that the waste is disposed of. So in the United States especially, there's a major problem with industrial pig farming particularly. So the feces, the urine, and the blood from large-scale slaughterhouses, all of that waste tends to be dumped in open-air cesspools, which are called lagoons, and they're located predominantly, almost exclusively, in poorer neighborhoods, and especially in communities of color and black neighborhoods. Here in Europe as well, the animal agriculture industry has its own problems. with sort of racial injustice and the disposal of animal waste, specifically against Romani and traveller communities in Europe. So, for example, in Slovakia, slaughterhouses, meat processing plants produce large amounts of waste, which are then disposed of and dumped in unfenced areas in locations which are frequented by Romani people and by traveller people. So when this happens, when the waste is disposed of in these communities, it poses a massive danger to the public health of these local communities because it pollutes the local air, the local water supplies, the local land, is increased risk of the zoonotic diseases, that, like you mentioned before, things like bird flu, swine flu, for example. And yet, white people largely are unaware of these problems because they're not in their areas. They're not, that the waste isn't disposed of. And so it's out of sight, out of mind. And that's why I think it ties in, going back to those principles we mentioned at the beginning about knowledge and awareness, is that a lot of us just aren't aware of these issues because they're not our lived experiences if we have white privilege.
I was impressed during the webinar how you talk about the numbers, the sheer number of animals that are being slaughtered each year. And so I'm going to do a little test with you right now, see if you remember your own presentation. But you said 70 billion animals are being slaughtered each year. And you said this in such an amazing way by comparing it to human populations. So you said that 70 billion is about 9 times of the human population on Earth right now. And then you talked about 300 plus million cows, which you said was the population of?
The USA.
Good job.
Yeah.
You talked about 1.5 billion pigs being slaughtered each year, which is approximately the population of?
Of China.
Yeah. Good job, you guys. But then I noticed that you humanized them by talking about how pigs exhibit some of the same traits and feelings of dogs and even small children or young children, and how chickens are complex and share cognitive abilities of math and counting, but also share emotional traits such as the ability to experience boredom, frustration, and even happiness. And I couldn't help but at some point think about the Declaration of Independence in the USA, where it says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." And these are beautiful words, but we even know that these rights were not being applied to African Americans till at least 1964. And there's still some question whether this is being applied appropriately to people in the USA or even outside of the USA. Does something like the Declaration of Independence or a Declaration of Human Rights exist for animals? Is there an animal's Declaration of Animal Rights, for example? Do animals have unalienable rights? And if so, what would those be?
I think the short answer is in practice, no.
Yeah.
In theory, there are some, I know, but, in practice, whether they actually get taken into account.
Yeah, certainly there aren't any. It doesn't seem on the ground that if they have inalienable rights, they certainly aren't respected. A few years ago, there were a group of animal rights activists who did try to draft sort of a Declaration of Animal Rights that was actually modelled on the Declaration of Independence. And the opening line said something along the lines of, "We hold this truth to be self-evident, that all beings have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of their happiness." Something that I find quite interesting as well, though, and that I only learned about recently, is that there is a proposed Universal Declaration on Animal Welfare that has been proposed to be adopted by the United Nations. And so that gives kind of a list of rights that animals have that deserve to be respected by all human nations. And the bar is set so low. That's the first thing that hit me when I was reading it. So the first one, to be recognized as living and sentient beings. So that's the first thing, because you'd think that would be taken for granted, but it's not. There was a debate in our parliament a few years ago about whether animals should be recognized legally as sentient beings. And it's not a scientific debate. Scientifically, it's absolutely clear that animals experience pleasure and pain, that they are conscious. But
you don't even need science to do that, though. Like, I've never even understood why people feel the need to have a... Like, if you tread on a dog's paw or a cow's foot, they're going to react. Obviously, they're alive and experience pain. I know, but there's scientifically, there's a lot more to it in that way. But for me, I feel like, come on, if we know that it experiences pain and it has a response to that, surely that's enough in some ways.
Absolutely. So that's just sort of the baseline, should be recognized as beings who are conscious subjects of their own lives. So independent of their usefulness to us, they have their own lives which matter to them as individuals. This Declaration on Animal Welfare that's been proposed also deserve to have their own interests considered and respected, the right to good physical and psychological health and well-being. And then it lists five freedoms that animals have the right to when they're dependent on us. And so the first is freedom from hunger, thirst, and malnutrition, freedom from fear and distress, freedom from physical and thermal discomfort, freedom from pain, injury, and disease, and freedom to express their normal patterns of behavior. And just echoing what Georgia said just now, I would say none of those rights are respected in current agricultural practices at all. So, I mean, I think when we talk about animal rights, it can be off-putting to some people because, you know, there are some human rights that are obviously specific to humans. You know, we're not going to give a dog the right to vote or say that a crocodile should have the right to an education or something like that. But I think, to me, it's a self-evident truth that animals do share some of these basic and fundamental rights with us, especially as we've learned more about the level of consciousness and intelligence that these animals possess. They're so comparable and similar to humans in so many respects. And so there are differences between the animal species, but in our sort of basic ability to experience suffering and to experience pain and in our desire to live, in that respect, animals are our equals.
There seems to be some type of hierarchy in the mistreatment of animals. It seems to be easier to mistreat a chicken than a cow simply because of the cow's size and strength. And this seems to be typical with humans as well. It's often the most vulnerable who suffer victimization and physical and psychological abuses. Do you think that some of the same issues of power and control are also at play when it comes to the treatment of or consumption of animals?
I think so, definitely. There's a famous quotation. It's been attributed to Gandhi. I can't verify that, but it has been around for a while, that says the greatness of a nation and its moral progress can be judged by the way its animals are treated. And I think that's very true, because animals really are the most vulnerable and most powerless of all beings in a human-dominated world. In a lot of ways, I think their position in society is quite similar to newborn babies, because like newborn babies, they can't even communicate using our human language to us. So they're totally at our mercy for us to inflict enormous suffering on them. And so I think the way that we treat or mistreat animals as a society says a lot about us and our moral character. And especially it says a lot about our attitudes towards those who are more vulnerable or less powerful than us.
Yeah. Let's talk about some specifics about food. So, for example, eggs and vegetarianism. Is it okay?
Like we said at the beginning, I think it's better to emphasize sort of principles rather than strict rules. The key is kind of knowledge and education. And so we do know that eggs are, in comparison to some other animal foods, eggs don't have as much of an environmental impact. But there is a lot of cruelty that goes into the egg industry. And I think it's misleading to pretend that it doesn't. And this actually was a large part of why I didn't go vegan for so long, was because I didn't know about a lot of this. So I went vegetarian because I thought, well, you know, I don't want an animal to die for me. And the way I thought, I was like, I mean, an animal doesn't care if I eat its eggs. Like, they're just going to get laid anyway. And I, you know, I'm sure the animal would be fine with me just, you know, eating an egg. I didn't understand anything really about the egg industry and how eggs are produced. So the majority of eggs come from chickens, from hens who are kept in battery cages. Things are getting better in certain countries, but it's still the case that the majority of eggs come from hens which are kept in these tiny, tiny cages virtually their entire lives. And even hens who aren't kept in those cages, in all egg farming systems, male chicks are killed within a day or two of being born because they're useless to the egg industry. A lot of people don't know this, and I didn't either for a long time. generally chickens are bred either for meat, so they're broiler chickens, in which case their sex, their gender is irrelevant. But then separately, you have chickens who are bred for eggs. And obviously, those male chicks are completely useless to the egg industry. They're just killed within a day or two of being born.
Basically usually ground alive.
Yeah.
It's like a conveyor belt where normally, like, they will be hatched, they'll come out, and they're still... nobody wants to see it, but, you know, if you don't believe it, kind of, you know, there's footage of it. And they come out of the shells, and the shells are literally still with them next to them on the conveyor belt. And it just goes along and drops them into an industrial grinder, and they're ground up alive. And I've seen it, and it was very hard and horrible to watch. But one thing I will say is how quick it just turns into a kind of consistency on that belt that honestly resembles the meat that you get in chicken nuggets from McDonald's. And I don't say that to try and, you know, detract from the horror of what goes on in it. But I think, you know, it does raise questions as well of, you know, where is that ground up male chick kind of, I don't even know what you'd call it, substance, concoction, where is that being used? Because, I don't know, maybe this is my little conspiracy tinfoil hat thing here, but, you know, I don't think for a minute that they don't sell it or try and make some kind of profit off it. And I think that, you know, that probably is what forms the basis, at least in part, for a lot of kind of cheap meats, maybe in pet food or in fast food chains, you know, all of this kind of thing. So there's so much cruelty that goes on in the egg industry that, you know, we're not aware of. I remember that was one of the most horrifying things that I learned.
Yeah.
It's a pattern throughout all of the animal agriculture industry, I think, is that a lot of the male young offspring are just kind of done away with in very cruel ways and then sold as cheap meat because, well, they're not as needed as the female one. And don't get me wrong, the life of the female animal is arguably worse. I mean, if you're a dairy cow, your life is to be forcefully impregnated. You know, it doesn't happen in a natural kind of way. There's not, in factory farms, there's not cows in the fields that mate, you know, that are artificially inseminated by a farmer, you know, shoving their hand up the female cow's vagina. And that happens several times. And then the baby cow is taken away from her within hours often of giving birth to it. Because, you know, we want the milk. You know, cows aren't different to other mammals. They produce milk for their offspring. They don't just produce it all the time. And yet that's something that I believed when I was younger. It was just that, you know, oh, cows make milk. They're milk machines. It's like, no, they're a mammal. You know, they make milk for their young. I know that's ended up detracting away from the idea of a hierarchy. But, yeah, I just thought it was important to mention there about the mistreatment that we don't see in a lot of products.
Well, I think it's a very important observation that mistreatment happens at all levels. And it's just a matter of which industry do you want to look at, and we can figure out what the issues are. I found it really interesting to listen to this webinar and also to be talking to you right now about this in our podcast. I would have never had this answer for eggs, for example. And now I have ways to talk about some of the problems that are still happening in factories and how that plays out with, for example, eggs. So let's talk about seafood and a plant-based diet. That was one of the questions from our webinar.
Yeah, I also just wanted to mention real quick about the eggs as well, is hopefully that, you know, they are currently, thanks to the work of a lot of activists that have exposed this cruel practice in the egg industry, there is technology being developed, I think mainly in Belgium and Germany, to sort out the sex of the chick that will be hatched before it is hatched, so that it won't mean that we will have live animals being ground up alive. And for that reason, I know that France, at least before COVID, I don't know whether it still stands, had made a pledge that I think by 2021 they were going to end the mass culling of male chicks, wasn't it? Yeah. I don't know whether that'll still happen, but, you know, if that does happen, I don't know, maybe the conversation about eggs will change again. But I think it is a mark of how important this kind of work and activism is, that it has changed the way, and people, you know, are becoming more aware. And because of this, of people turning around to the industry and saying that's not okay, this technology for the first time is being considered, and people are trying to develop it, which, yeah. Sorry, I know we're talking about seafood. I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah. So the question was about seafood. And is seafood okay on a plant-based diet? And I think, Georgia, you responded to that in the question and answer time after the webinar. Do you want to respond again to that for this podcast?
Yeah, sure. I mean, people have very different opinions on seafood because not all seafood is created equal as well, in a way. I mean, seafood can involve dolphins and sharks and, you know, big fish that, you know, definitely are sentient and have emotions and think and feel and experience pain and stuff. But then within that, there's also the case of bivalves and like types of shellfish, like oysters and mussels and things like this, which under the current sort of scientific understanding, it's believed that they're not sentient, at least anyway. So, I mean, you'll get different answers from different kind of plant-based advocates as to whether they can be included in even a strict vegan diet and stuff. I think they're really gross personally. I've tried them before and I'm not a fan. But I definitely, you know, think it's something that's really good to consider, especially if you are concerned about nutrition and, you know, and about going 100% vegan and stuff. So in terms of seafood more generally, again, it's such an individual thing. I always hesitate to give out kind of a strict kind of thing on that. We're very sort of cagey about doing that, I think, has probably been made clear. But I think it's just worth remembering that the idea of being plant-based specifically just means that you're based predominantly on plants. It's, you know, it's kind of in the name. If you were having seafood very, very, very occasionally, you can still say that you're plant-based, you know, and lots of people do. Again, I think it's going to be a personal choice kind of thing. I personally believe that obviously fish and, you know, and sea life in that way has sentience and therefore has worth and should be able to live out its life, especially because of their importance in the cleanliness and stuff in the ocean as well, all the important role they have there. But yeah, like, you know, technically can be included as part of a plant-based diet. And in terms of environmental issues, it's definitely a lot better source of protein than, you know, chicken or especially red meat and stuff. It's a much better source of animal-based protein. But then, you know, it's such a complicated issue because as I'm saying that, you know, there's so many things that come to mind, like the plastic from fishing nets and all the bykill of animals like dolphins and whales. And, you know, yeah, like it's such a complicated issue. And I mean, you know, I've just been saying about shellfish, but even with that, you know, they have an important role in the ocean. Which is, you know, they're bottom feeders, aren't they? A lot of them, like, they help to clean and purify the ocean and stuff and manage the levels of oxygen and all kinds down there. So if we, you know, if we start overly relying on them, we're just going to end up in the same situation. So it really is just something where I don't think there is an easy answer. I think that's why we prefer the more sort of principles sort of approach, like we keep saying in this. I know we'll probably sound like a broken record. But just because I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all approach to diet, and I don't think we can say, well, this one is less harmful and that one is super harmful. And, you know, it's just, it's all very different and up in the air.
Yeah, it is interesting how quick it becomes complex. And one of those questions of complexity is about science. So what about genetically modified foods? Tell us about that, especially in relationship to a plant-based diet. Are there any concerns people should have about genetically modified foods?
I just talked everyone's ear off about fish. Yes. Maybe you'd like to go.
So I think genetically modified foods are a very divisive topic. That's the first thing that I'd want to acknowledge, is that different people have very different opinions about it. Even different scientists have very different opinions about it as well. As far as I can tell, there's not really an overwhelming consensus among scientists, because the relationship between food and the environment is very complex and there's multiple factors to consider. So that's the first thing I'd want to acknowledge, is that it's a very divisive issue. And partly for that reason, I'm always a little bit hesitant to say either that, you know, genetically modified foods are 100% fine and you need to eat genetically modified foods on a plant-based diet. But I'm also very hesitant to say that if you're going to be plant-based, then you need to only eat organic fruits and vegetables and things like that. Because my worry is that then that can lead to becoming even more restrictive. And as I spoke about before, about sort of self-care, I think that can be quite a dangerous sort of road to go down.
There's different levels with it as well. I mean, something that I touched on in the Q&A after the webinar is that I think that genetically modified can mean so many different things. You know, you can you can be referring to tomatoes that have been modified to increase or decrease the amount of seeds in them to make them, you know, have a better yield or to need less pesticides and stuff. But you can also be talking about modified sugars and corn syrups and stuff and colours have been used to be added into candy or, like, you know, ready meals and stuff. Like, I don't think there's a clear answer, because genetically modified can mean so many different things. And especially in terms of the fruits and vegetables, you know, sorry to bring class into it again, but it's just, it's if you're already asking people to, you know, buy from this source and do that, and also avoid meat and then do this, and then also you need to buy organic fruits and vegetables and beans and stuff. Like I said, we tried it a couple of times and it, like, nearly tripled our shopping bill, you know. And we're, you know, we don't struggle even, but, you know, if you were someone that is living in a very vulnerable situation and is dependent upon benefits or things like this, that's going to be nearly impossible for you to afford to do all of that. Like, so I think it, I just think it's too divisive of a topic, really. Yeah.
And I think too complex of a topic as well to give us a simple, straightforward good or bad characterization. There are, I mean, are there concerns with monocropping and some forms of genetic modification? Absolutely. But also there can be benefits to selectively breeding crops to ensure that they are, you know, more resistant to insects, or that they have a bigger yield, which means that you can feed people more efficiently. So I think there's advantages and disadvantages, and in either case, you know, you can be plant-based and not eat any genetically modified crops if you want to, if you're concerned about them. But in the same breath, you don't have to avoid GM food if you want to be plant-based.
We talked about this as being a divisive topic, and I think that food in general and what we eat can be very divisive when we're talking with other people in our own families and our community, especially in our socio-political associations that we have with people around us and in the world and on many political agendas as well. One of the things I really love about both of you is your ability to be convicted of veganism and even insistent when necessary, but you're both very conscious that not everyone may be where you are in your culinary journey and with your animal rights journey. Has this always been your position, or did it take time to get there? And then I'd like you to reflect a little bit on Apostle Paul's words, where basically he says that the foods that we eat shouldn't divide us. The fellowship should not be divided by the different things that are on our plates. And how would you, what would you respond to that counsel given by Paul?
I think personally, something that I find interesting about that counsel is that I think that in a way, providing a plant-based meal can be a way of making it very non-divisive and not dividing a fellowship. You know, there's so many people from different backgrounds and cultures with food restrictions. And, you know, maybe you can touch on this more because you know more about it than I do, being, you know, with RE and stuff. But to my knowledge, there's not really any sort of religious or cultural kind of strictures against, like, you know, say, like, beans and fruit and vegetables and stuff. So I think in many ways, if we're thinking of how we can, you know, make our dinner table and our plates, you know, peace and affirming and, you know, bringing people together, it can be a really good way to avoid those kind of battles in a way, is to focus on kind of those plant-based whole foods. You don't have to get into things to do with kosher and halal and things like that. It kind of, I don't want to say negates it, because that would be reducing a whole cultural history and background to do with food just massively. But I think it definitely mitigates it at least a lot, you know, if that's the kind of focus of the meal.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, because at a lot of interfaith meals that I have seen advertised and things like that, very often they will explicitly make it vegan because it's the easiest way to ensure that it's inclusive and welcoming to everybody. So I think that's a really good point about how food can actually be uniting rather than divisive, mm-hmm. and how plant-based food especially has that potential. I also think with that particular passage from Paul in Romans, if I remember rightly, he's speaking about meat that's been sacrificed to idols and the division in the Christian church and the early Christian church around whether it was okay to eat that type of meat or not. His personal opinion, again, if I remember right, is that it doesn't really matter that much. He says everything is clean, but also be respectful of each other's food choices. I do think that the kind of conversation that we're having is slightly different, because what Paul is talking about, there aren't really any major ethical implications to it as to whether it's been, you know, sacrificed in a religious ceremony or not. There are major ethical implications with the current way that we eat. So I do think it is important to be bold and to be open and to be honest about having those conversations, even when they're uncomfortable and even if they cause very, very strong opinions to be aired. But I think we also need to affirm what we have in common and a sort of shared values. And I think a major part of that is just dialogue. And I think one of the major areas where activists sometimes run into problems is that we're sometimes very eager to talk and to sort of speak the truth that we found out, and we forget to listen to what the other person is saying and to where they're coming from and what their experience is. And I think just listening to what somebody is saying, listening to where they're at, and affirming that and recognizing that is their experience can provide a good foundation for a relationship and nurturing those relationships, which then mean that those conversations can be had in a way that's less divisive and causes fewer problems. Mm-hmm.
I know that listening for me, before I moved to England, I had to decide where I wanted to move. And I listened to many different ideas of places that would be good. And I eventually chose Leicester because of its great diversity, especially it has a Southern Asian influence in Leicester. And one of the things that I listened to was people talking about different diets. And when I would have guests from different faiths or from different faith movements, that it might be important to offer a vegetarian, at least, if not vegan, option so that everyone could be included. Everyone could have a place around the table. So your webinar ended with some easy steps that we could take. Would you mind mentioning again what those steps were? And for anyone listening to this podcast who might not have caught the webinar.
Yeah, so our first one was to check your labels, basically mean and have a honest sort of look and conversation with yourself or the people you live with about how dependent we truly are on animal products. You know, like, where are the sort of sneaky ingredients? Because you might think, well, I only eat meat once or twice a week, it's not that bad. But if you look on soups and in sauces, you know, if it's milk, it's eggs, it's a bit here and there. And you start to see a picture emerging of, wow, like, there's so much actually in my diet that I'm not even aware of. And that awareness, I think, is good, regardless of what you choose to do with it. Just having that awareness is so important, because, you know, it comes down to the self-care thing of taking care of yourself, having that kind of intention with what you're eating. I would argue that's a good practice mentally, regardless of how you choose to eat. And then there was also trying plant-based alternatives, you know, kind of having fun with it, living in a time as we do now, where in most countries, anyway, most places, there are so many alternatives and more coming out all the time, you know. There's so many things as well that are actually accidentally vegan or plant-based. You know, my personal favorite is chili heatwave Doritos. Those are really nice. And then there was also supporting Black-owned businesses and products as a way to try and combat a lot of the racism and cultural appropriation that goes on in packaging and just in the food industry in general. You know, giving back to those communities and going with them directly rather than, you know, going through some big corporate white-owned kind of business that has appropriated traditional sort of recipes and things, yeah, in a racist manner. And then also was to, if you feel like you can, is to consider going plant-based or fully vegan, and kind of in line with that, learning more about nutrition and maybe considering attending a local slaughterhouse vigil yourself to kind of get involved with that element as well.
How would you encourage people to get involved? Is there any type of event that people need to be aware of? Is there any special date that people need to keep in mind, or a step that someone can take right now to get involved?
Coming up in less than 3 months is World Vegan Day. Which I believe is on the 1st of November. So if you, if anybody is interested in trying to be vegan, it might just be for a day. If the thought of going vegan or of eating plant-based food is really scary to you, maybe just try on that day. Have that as a day where you say, I'll try not to eat any animal products this day. And just do it as an experiment. See how easy do you find it? How difficult do you find it? And that's an opportunity to reflect on. Or it might be if you're more kind of firmly committed and you think, yeah, I want to make this transition completely, then that might be a good day to aim for. Because often around that time, it can make it a bit easier because companies sometimes bring out more vegan products around that time. So that's one possibility. Another really good time to consider changing your diet up a little bit is in January, or Veganuary, as it's called sometimes. So it's spelled like January, but with vegan instead of the J-A-N. And if you type that word Veganuary into social media, I believe they probably have a website as well. They're just really good at giving you loads of tips and advice for people who are complete newcomers to veganism and who might only be trying it out for a month. So some people decide, okay, for this month, I'm just going to try and be plant-based and see how I find it. It also, again, coincides with often companies, supermarkets, bring out more plant-based foods and also often have offers and reductions in the prices of plant-based foods. So it's a great time to just experiment and try new things and see how you find it.
Yeah, and another good one as well is, you know, if you are particularly interested in, attending a vigil or something, it's the SAVE movement, isn't it? If you search on, like, you know, Facebook just for that and then the name of, you know, your area or, like, you know, slaughterhouse vigil and stuff near me, there'll be a lot of options that will come up if you do feel like you can do something like that. It's also maybe a bit dodgy here, maybe a little bit of a plug, but I do have a YouTube channel that I want to start posting recipes on. So if you want to see some really cheap kind of vegan recipes that are thrown together in student kitchen style.
How do we access that?
I think it's just my name, actually. Yeah, just my name, Georgia Commons. Yeah.
Okay, we can find that on YouTube. Guys, is there anything else that we would need to talk about today? I think we've talked about so many different things.
Yeah.
In such an informative session. But is there anything that you wanted to make sure to mention before we come to the end of this podcast?
You think of anything else? I think we covered it.
I think we've about covered everything. I mean, with each of these issues, we could spend a whole podcast on each subtopic and each sort of sub issue. But I think we've given sort of explored a whole range of issues surrounding our food system and animal agriculture. So
we should have. And I only have one more question before we end today, because food and gathering around food is so important in Community of Christ. And we have these things called potlucks. And you guys have mentioned several times in this podcast already snacks that you love to gather and form community through the vegan and vegetarian community through snacks. So tell me, if you were to come to a Community of Christ potluck and it was a plant-based potluck, what would be some of the exciting things that you might see offered on the table?
Something other than falafels.
The go-to vegetarian vegan.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like when I first went vegan, I liked them. But, I've just got so sick of them over the years because, you know, whenever I'd go to like an event at uni, they'd be like, it's okay. We're going to have vegan options. And I'd get there and they'd be like, have a falafel. And I'd be like, oh, okay, thanks. You know, and I'm grateful for it still, obviously, you know, and I'd eat it. But, it can be a bit much if you've been having that at like any kind of get together for like 5 years straight.
Something that I would hope and expect to see a lot of just simple meals that can be made plant-based so easily. So there is such a variety of vegan soups that you can make and plant-based soups. So there's lentil soup, you know, carrot and coriander, just so many different types. You can, you know, obviously put so many different ingredients into it, but also chilies.
I was going to say chili, like a nice bean chili soup with some hummus or like vegan cheese on the top. Very nice. I'm really passionate about soup.
Yeah, but so many others as well. I think I'm always, the reason I'm almost finding it difficult to think is just that virtually any meal that you think of that you enjoy, if you type into Google, I don't know, say if you really like spaghetti bolognese, you can just type in, you know, vegan spaghetti bolognese recipe, and mm-hmm. and you'll come up with a whole list of different recipes and mm-hmm. ideas. So honestly, I would expect and hope to see a lot of the same foods that are at a usual Community of Christ potluck, just without the animals.
Yeah.
Well, Georgia and Ryan, thank you both so much for being a part of this follow-up podcast for the 2020 European Peace Colloquy webinar series. Thank you for your time and for your important reflections on nonviolence and what we put on our plates as we continue to move towards becoming a more peaceful humanity. And thank you to all of our listeners. Join us next time to listen to Ellis Brooks share about making soldiers out of children, military recruitment, and our youth, and asking the question, or answering the question, is there space for peace in our schools? As we all continue to explore together our many different grounds for peace.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.